Okay, that's absolutely fine. It was my fault.
I'm kidding. Listen, we're on the air, so that's fair warning.
Oh my God.
It has happened that quick because you know what? When you tell people 3 o'clock and you come in at 3:01, you've lost the one listener you had.
They've already gone. They're gone.
Absolutely. It's just me and you now. So we can talk safely. This is DS106 Radio. It's May 6th. It's Wednesday. Is it Wednesday where you are?
Yeah, just about.
It is. And we're Lauren and I, Lauren Haywood from Coventry. You want to introduce yourself, Lauren?
Hello, I'm Lauren Haywood from Coventry.
I almost did it as well. I didn't have the British accent, unfortunately. And we're here to talk about Utopia, of all things. What an odd topic in a moment of a pandemic, in a time when maybe that's what we need, or at least need to think about.
Yeah,
it's like
absolutely.
A mental health radio show. So anyway, you shared with me a couple of really cool essays talking about a wide range of stuff and a lot of stuff I was deeply taken with and sent me on a whole rabbit hole into like VHS archiving and stuff I never thought I'd read about in that kind of detail. It was awesome. But anyway, why don't you set up for our listeners a little bit the essays, some of the ideas, and then I think from there we can just jump into a conversation, right?
Yeah, sure. So the first essay I sent you was by Jonah Stahl. So these are two essays that are available on eFlux, so you can go and look for them. We can link them out in Twitter in a sec. The first one's by Jonah Stahl, who's an artist, titled Comrades in Deep Future. And it's quite a long essay, but it kind of goes through basically capitalist ideas at the moment, or extractivist ideas of what we might want to do when we reach Mars, or why we'd want to go into space once we decide Earth is over, I suppose. And kind of looking at, I don't know, Bezos and Musk and different people's ideas of how we might want to organize society on Mars. But it kind of introduces this idea that individuals like that aren't necessarily interested in organizing society. They're looking at ways of extracting mineral wealth, or playing with technology and things like that, how to actually get to other planetary bodies and things like that. And then it kind of leads into how literature and art has kind of use the idea of going to other planets as a thought of experiment about trying to apply how you could scale up to a planetary scale, like autonomous zones or kind of anarchist or communist ways of organizing society or labor and things like that. I'm scrolling through. I haven't read it that recently. I should have read it yesterday. But
I read it this morning. I really loved it. And you know what I thought about right away, Lauren? I thought about Total Recall. Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah.
Because they're on Mars. They're extracting minerals. Like, it's basically reproducing all the worst inequalities of Earth, but on Mars. And I just, immediately went to that imaginary. But I think it was interesting. There's many interesting things about the essay. And I tweeted it out so people can get a link to it. But one of the things I really found fascinating about it was the idea of the Soviet idea of propaganda, and then Donna Haraway talking about the value of propaganda, and then the author moving to talk about Octavia Butler and Ursula K. Le Guin and the idea of possible futures, right? Like between anarcho-syndicalism, this whole kind of movement around Earthseed and the ideas that Octavia Butler talks about in several of her novels. It was wide-ranging, but it was really cool to see that what I read, and I'd be interested to get your take on this, what I read as the kind of core idea, and it's something I deeply believe in, of any movement, whether it be Elon Musk's SpaceX or Ursula K. Le Guin's anarcho-syndicalism on faraway worlds, or even Octavia Butler's Earthseed kind of post-moment, like the person said, yeah, Octavia Butler's novels almost read like documentaries now, given her moment, which I think is true.
Absolutely. But
it's interesting because Donna Haraway ties these all together around this idea of the importance of propaganda and understanding and executing propaganda for whatever your cause is in a thoughtful, almost like dialogic way, which I thought was really cool. Am I wrong with that?
No, that is cool. I think as all the essay talks about that kind of trying to imagine through art and literature how those models might actually work, given that we live in a world where we don't have, you know, like statewide or planetary scales kind of anarchism or whatever else. Trying to see and think through how that would actually work, and you know, Ursula Le Guin kind of has, you know, uses in The Dispossessed, you know, Mars, that's kind of like this anarcho-syndicalist way of organizing society that's kind of performing labor to make money for the capitalist society back on Earth. But it allows you to compare how those two, you know, societies work and kind of directly contrast them, but also explore the kind of lines where that kind of modeling of society might not work, or the assumptions we make, because, you know, if we're modeling on a much smaller scale, you know, what are the things that we're possibly not thinking through, or that we only take us so far as we're kind of challenging the current system and not imagining, you know, this new system completely detached from the kind of moment we're living through now. So, yeah, it's just that kind of process of imagining, allowing the reader to imagine and kind of pick apart those ideas, but also understand them, I suppose, in a similar way to how, you know, propaganda as a tool helps people bring people into new ideas and things like that as well.
Yeah, and I really liked, and I'm trying to keep my levels down a little bit because I think they might be a little high, but one of the things I was really kind of struck by is the way in which the author, Jonas Stahls, takes, you know, these various science fiction approaches from, you know, early Russia, like turn of the century Russian literature, to the 60s to the 80s, or no, 70s, I think would be Ursula K. Le Guin, and the way in which they wrap that around people like Elon Musk and their kind of like nation state approach to space. Like, oh, it's just another space. We treat it just as we treat everything we're doing here. We reproduce, you know, the same evils that maybe we have and that made things like that happen. And I was just really struck by that because we don't think about that, right? Like, we just think of Mars like, oh yeah, there's a probe out there and they're grabbing a little gravel. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I guess it's getting realer now with the SpaceX thing, but it didn't really occur to me, although it probably did, but it should have in more direct terms, you know, that this is really a power grab. You know, it's an industrial power grab of interplanetary, you know, scale. And that was really striking. And then I read in the article too that, you know, Jeff Bezos is actually a competing kind of space pioneer with his Blue Origin, which I had not known about till reading this article. Like, it says, okay. Yeah, it says, the state idea is shared by figures such as Jeff Bezos, founder of the trillion-dollar company Amazon, who I think we're all familiar with, whose business model is based on structural tax evasion and the extreme exploitation and precarization of its worker. This has enriched Bezos to such a degree that he has been able to create his own company for space exploration, Blue Origin. Who knew, right? That's crazy.
I think it's, as well, the essay points out that those individuals entirely ignore the need for any kind of governance or cultural infrastructures.
Yep.
That's right. I think it even points out, like, it makes a joke of the fact that Musk has said that, you know, he wants a bar or whatever on the planet, and that's the only mention in anywhere in SpaceX's kind of documentation about how they imagine life on Mars would exist. They want a bar, that's it. But just the idea of having access to cinema or entertainment or any kind of cultural production is entirely ignored, and there's no governance structure at all. But it is the fact that Bezos and Musk and individuals like that, perhaps they're already operating in ways where they're kind of, especially Bezos, is able to ignore, is deliberately ignoring kind of, you know, models of taxation and things like that that exist, you know, on our home planet. So why would he look to try and replicate any of those models on a new planet that he wants to colonize? So it just, it kind of shows up that, but also the ridiculousness of that. So that they're talking about life on Mars and wanting to create a new planet for people to live on and move to. And that might be, you know, humanity's future, but in humanity's future, they only see extraction of a planet's resources as the point of continuing humanity. Do you know what I mean? There's no other kind of consideration there. It's just, it's quite a playful essay as well. And like you say, it kind of, it meanders a lot. It kind of goes through all these different kind of sci-fi approaches to thinking of new ways of organizing life on a planet or how to model politics and things like that.
Yeah.
Also, I was just scrolling down as well. And there's a few, I was having a conversation with someone recently about, because I'm on a bit of a, I've gone back to binging sci-fi again. I don't know what that means. Maybe I'm looking for kind of escapes or whatever else. But it's got a screenshot here from Claire Denis' High Life, which I linked to a few people to ask if they wanted to watch it. And the couple of people that did, they said it was all right. They liked it for like the set design and the costuming and stuff like that, but they didn't really like the story. But I couldn't really explain why I liked the story, but I like the fact that it's in this essay because it's...
Is that the one with the two robots who are going to go about planting trees?
No, that's Silent Running. Yeah, that's a 70s film. This one's from a couple of years back, High Life. Huh. But it's some people on a ship where they're basically people that have done petty crimes and they're put on a ship, basically sent towards a black hole to see if they survive or what the toll on the human body is by kind of entering the orbit of a black hole. So a lot of it's kind of dealing with futility or how we value human life and stuff like that.
It sounds like Las Vegas right now.
Yeah, and so I don't know, it's just interesting that I really like this essay. Maybe that's a reason why I like films like that, because it kind of considers, I suppose, the point of human life or how we value human life and things like that.
Well, it also is reminiscent of Blade Runner and the whole idea of a disposable. So you
just mentioned loads of Philip K. Dick stuff here. Yeah. You're entering it from the film view rather than reading short stories and stuff.
Yeah, it's funny the Martian time slip. I mean, so much of Philip K. Dick is kind of imagining these, like doing exactly what this essay is talking about, basically transplanting all the problems with our current system within different contexts that just have the backdrop of space, right?
and he does the same thing with having Mars and Earth, constantly having those two planets, like obviously with them in Blade Runner, there's always this suggestion that, you know, like basically some people are left on Earth and there's loads of replicants there and low level kind of classes kind of still working in whatever way, but the people that can afford to leave the planet have already left. So it's like this sense of abandonment and I suppose again, a futility in around like whose life is worth something or whatever. But yeah, as well, like there's lots of stuff around, so extractivism is the idea of like the politics of just extracting resources and stockpiling them, and like doing that just purely to hoard mineral wealth as well. So there's lots of discussion, and I'm just explaining that as a term because I just said it before.
No, I appreciate it.
Yeah, and lots of Philip K. Dick stories as well. There's ideas of, yeah, that futility of going to planets and fighting wars over just taking stuff from other planets and other people, and people belligerently saying, no, we just need to do that. That's the point, you know, and you should care about it because us as a planet, we care or we need that resource kind of thing.
It's a trope now, right? I mean, think of any times it's, you know, when we're invaded, it's about by an alien population or whatever that needs our resources, whether it's the water or the oxygen, or like there's always this idea of rape and pillage as kind of the way we live through, you know, interstellar relations, which is depressing. But it's interesting, I mean, because we started talking immediately about Musk, Elon Musk and Bezos, right? And both of them, this is kind of why this essay seems such like a current event to me. You know, it was written in 2019, but it really was striking in its resonance at this moment. And that is because, one, I just read that Elon Musk, given the nature of the business and stuff, is about to get the $666 million bonus from I think, Tesla, not to mention the SpaceX stuff. And like you think about that when 25%, coming on 25% of the world's population could be, well, I can't say that. At least the mark of unemployment in the U.S. right now is approaching 20%, and we'll probably far more than that when this is over. And to hear that news is just disgusting. And then on top of that, you got Tim Bray, who's a VP of Amazon Web Services, who stepped down publicly from his position, given that, you know, Amazon continues to, you know, in this moment of crisis and global pandemic, you know, squeeze its labor for everything, using a culture of fear and exploitation, doing the very things that this essay is framing out is what these people are trying to export. That extraction, the extraction of labor, the extraction of value to leave a dead planet, right? Whether it's revive a dead planet or to leave one that they're going away from. It really struck me, like reading this and then the current news that you don't have to look too far on Twitter or anywhere that you read to see that, you know, Octavia Butler, they're right. Like, that's not science fiction anymore. This isn't speculative fiction. You know, like, she's writing about a future that we've inherited more so than ever in the last 4 years. It's crazy. So I found this essay really kind of like jarring in its relevance to my kind of, you know, mentality underneath the lockdown. I don't know if you were trying to mess with me by pointing me to these links, but it worked.
Yeah, I'll say as well, like, I think, I don't know, because we were going to talk about utopia, and obviously some of the things that we've discussed are definitely dystopias, or even like, I don't know, like Le Guin's Dispossessed isn't a utopian fiction. It's just people are made to work on a colony planet, and then they organize society in a way that fits their humanity kind of thing. So they still have to labor for this other planet, but they decide to organize themselves in a way where their humanity is recognized and, you know, thinking through what's best for their young people and all this kind of stuff. Rather than it just being entirely detached and just like, oh, well, if we could have the best life, how would we organize kind of things? But there's still hope in that, or there's an interesting thing there where thinking about that being possible under like the current system, or that you might be able to imagine that as a future kind of thing.
I'll tell you, I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you go.
I saw some of the hope that you're talking about in Donna Haraway's quote. Let me find it. It's pretty compelling. So at the end of... Hold on. That's my house. I think that's a delivery from Amazon. Okay. Let's see. So Donna Haraway words, this demands a form of sympoiosis. So I'm reading from the essay. And I'm going to go down to this last line and then read a bit of the quote. But how in a time that is beginning to meet the criteria of the uninhabitable world that Octavia Butler describes so aptly in her parable diptych, do we propagate such simultaneous inter and intra planetary assemblies? What, in other words, would be our art of hyperempathy? So let me take a moment here before I read the rest. Is here, this essay is talking about this notion of hyperempathy. And it's talking about this idea of, you know, rejecting certain things around, you know, the world that we live in has to be kind of modeled, or the world that we would find or explore or, how would you say, pioneer in space, has to be built on top of what we know. You know, capitalism, kind of that Wallerstein. Emmanuel Wallerstein was a sociologist who said, basically, the global capitalist system is almost impossible to think outside of, because everybody in some ways is connected by it and dependent upon it, even if you stand outside of it as a kind of communist, socialist kind of entity. Good example of that was Cuba, right? As much as Cuba wanted to be apart from the capitalist system, ultimately, at the end of the day, it was dependent upon its kind of extraction, its value, its logic of thinking, even to exist outside of it, which it really couldn't, which I think is interesting. And I think what this idea of hyperempathy, or what Haraway is talking about, like this notion of propaganda, is a really interesting kind of hopeful idea. So rather than propaganda only always being something that you're, imprisoned by? I think for her, it's a way to liberate an idea, right? And she kind of talks about both Le Guin and Octavia Butler, two great science fiction writers, as actual propagandists in some ways. But I don't think she means that in a negative way. So here's the quote from Haraway. I don't work by simplification, and I am rarely drawn by art that works by reduction. I am a polemicist, an ideologue. I think doing really good propaganda is something we really got to figure out how to get better at. I'm really interested in propaganda as a form that need not be full of alt anything, referring to the alt-right, that can be a practice of collecting each other up and telling important truths with a certain kinds of tonalities. And I really... For me, that's DS-106 radio in my mind. I know it sounds horrible, but I believe in an alternative aesthetic and an alternative notion of propaganda, which is why I use the Russian image when we talk about the show. It's why I use the kind of utopic sci-fi visual. Like, I am really drawn towards the visual aesthetic of utopia, of science fiction, of an alternative, whether it's architecture, and we'll talk more about that, but I was really drawn by that. And for me, that quote by Haraway is really empowering and kind of reinforces a lot of what I think about educational technology, that more of it is about propaganda and aesthetic and bringing and collecting people together who believe in this stuff, than it is about the shopping, the extraction, the surveillance, you know, all the things that seem to get to the point you said of the extractionist mentality, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense. I think as well, so in the essay as well, it talks about that all of the characters in these utopias or these alternative models of how society could exist lots of the characters take on a kind of steward role or they're gardeners and things like that. So you mentioned Silent Runnings before. So there's like in that film, it's like a collection of humans and robots living together, carrying out the last plants or some of the last plants that exist on Earth out into space, just so some kind of life that exists on Earth continues to live in space as the planet that perhaps is going through kind of some sort of climate collapse or whatever. But the protagonist in the story is like has this gardener role, and then the robots are kind of ultimately charged with looking after this plant life indefinitely as this ship floats off into space, kind of thing. And some of the other characters that I mentioned within this essay are also have that gardener role. So it mentions a character in one film. I don't want to say unless people have. I want people to watch these films as if without giving them away or whatever as well. But like in one of the films, it mentions one of the characters kind of basically chooses to die on the ship, and it kind of their body becomes part of the compost of the garden on the ship and things like that. So there's different kind of maybe kind of more metaphorical ways of kind of taking stewardship, or kind of your body or your existence is part of this kind of collective or a whole kind of like sense of humanity or life rather than just your individual value or life.
I'll tell you, I really like that whole part. And two things that on that. One, the whole idea of the human is combustible and, ultimately the botanist saving, the ecosystem or what have you, that they create the biome. But, and there's a
I think
visual. I'm sorry, go ahead.
the point that I was going to make with that as well, I was trying to think where I was going with that to
Yeah.
start talking about. But I think as well, if we wanted to talk about ed tech and things like that as well, there's this quote. I got some books out earlier because I was trying to think of where different ideas, because I read stuff and then I just like with this essay, I just haven't read it for a while. I was surprised. There's a quote from. I'm going to rattle around a lot of stuff off the table. I've got there's a artist group called Meta Haven, so this is one of their publications, and they do stuff. One of their works is called The Sprawl Propaganda About Propaganda, so they're interested in that, and they're really good friends with Benjamin Bratton and people like that. So
Cool.
Benjamin Bratton came up with the idea of the sprawl and the sprawl the stack. But yeah, in here there's some people discussing, and it's actually Mackenzie Walk, who I now know more about and I've read more of her work, which she said the greatest socialist utopia that actually got built is service infrastructure. Electrical grids, rail transport, municipal maintenance functions, and one of the truly great realized utopias, running water and sewerage, and the lines that keep chaos and violence at bay. So like I don't know, with ed tech and things like that, creating good infrastructure that works for a lot of people, that alleviates problematic kind of labor conditions and things like that, or that gives people, I don't know, access to things to things I don't know, in the broadest sense. I don't know, that's something that stuck in my mind, but I can't remember who said it. And then when I realized it was Mackenzie Walk, who she re recently released a book called Capital Is Dead, Is This Something Worse? So she's kind of she talks about vectoral capital, and it kind of goes alongside ideas of surveillance capitalism and platform capitalism. But vectoral capital is this idea of another form of capital happening over the kind of the way that we know capitalism works at the moment. This idea of she's basically trying to explore how Bezos and Musk and people like that that own the overriding infrastructures and kind of information systems that we have now. When we talk about like means of production and stuff like that, like how does this other kind of logistical system, how does that layer on top, and trying to explain the inequality there and stuff. So like if we wanted to, if we're talking about technology and things like that and utopias, the idea of kind of stewarding or creating infrastructures that don't create kind of hierarchical problems or misuse people's labor and stuff like that. I don't. So I just I think that's where I was going with the trying to think how those ideas link together.
Well, it's interesting what you're saying, because it links on to that whole thing with Tim Bray and Amazon Web Services. So he works for Amazon Web Services. He's a VP. He's very well paid. All of them are in that sphere of AWS, right? Like, because that's the infrastructure piece, right? Like, that's the piece that's basically privatizing, you know, the water distribution, the electric grid, all things that are utilities that, at least in the U.S., have some kind of oversight and regulation, given the fact that they're necessary, right? And even that is a constant struggle in the U.S., but there's some even patina of that. Whereas that's not the case with the internet. And the idea of the utility and infrastructure like AWS, which we realized more than ever how much we need this stuff in these days. And Tim Bray said, just even the distinction and the difference in treatment between the people who work in the warehouse and deliver this stuff and the people who build and work for AWS and the kind of virtual infrastructure is a kind of have and have not, political class system within the company itself. And it's really interesting listening to you talk about, those infrastructures that are invaluable for equality and a better sense of life being things we don't even think about technologically, like running water, an electrical grid, you know, certain things that, right, at this point we take for example, but like that's none of that is given right now in the technical world and in the ed tech world and the world where we do our business by and large now entirely. So it's a really interesting thought to think about that. I was also speaking of the garden piece you were talking about. One of the things this made me think of when we first started saying, I think last week we said, let's do a show about utopias, and kind of lift some spirits, right? We're not doing a very good job of that, but that's all right. But one of the things I thought about, there was a book written by a guy named Douglas Murphy. And I haven't read the book, so I'm going to be clear here. But I have read the review in The Guardian, and I'll tweet it out. But in this book, it's super interesting because this book kind of chronicles the almost utopian optimism of the 60s and 70s architecture. A lot of what is featured is in the U.S. and in Great Britain during that time. And it talks about the kind of, geodesic domes of people like Buckminster Fuller, the idea of these ziggurats where no two apartments were the same, but they were kind of like pyramid shaped, and just a whole sense of like, a utopian idea of building space that's going to change the way we interact, change the way we think of the world we inhabit. And the really interesting thing about the review and the book, which I've ordered now, is it talks about all of those things like open space designs, supermarkets, distributed warehouses, and all of these things which were part of that 60s and 70s utopian vision became the blueprint for surveillance, for control. So all of those open frameworks became the kind of grid and map by which so much of the utopian promise was, commodified, captured, and in many ways, how would you say, co-opted. And that has been an almost, I did a presentation just based on reading the review of a book, because I don't do any research for anything I ever present. I just talk about whatever I want, which is why people stopped inviting me, which is probably good. But the idea for me mapped one-to-one on the Web 2.0 utopian, it's all possible, we can do this. I mean, there was a sense of utopia when we were working in this field, for many of us, 2006, 2007, we were like, woohoo! Like, you're gonna blow the doors off this. There is gonna be a new aesthetic. We are gonna do things differently. We don't have to depend upon the infrastructure of the institution. We can build our own, all of that. But people like Audrey Waters, Chris Gilliard, and other folks in like 2012, 2013. And I think the wheels were coming off the ship long before that. But they started to draw the dots, at least for me, and say, like, actually, your utopia is kind of a nightmare. And here's why. And it's interesting because I think that is the book that was written about 60s and 70s utopian architecture could be written about 2000, mid-2000s utopian technology gone to, you know, a very dark place for many of us that I think we're almost kind of trying to emerge from. But, I mean, we're still stuck in this strange moment. But does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think it is that case of some of that comes down to governance, doesn't it? Because, I'm trying to think through. I think trying to say that anything is possible and creating the structures where anything is possible is actually, well, who has the time and who has the means to actually make those things possible? And the co-option comes in when there's still those existing power dynamics where some people still have the money, the means to employ people, just like the bloody mindedness that a particular option is like the only option. So I think you still need governance structures around how to make use of that. So you make something that anyone can use, that it's available to everyone. It kind of speaks to kind of universal rights and things like that. But then, I don't know, I was looking at, I've got like a half blog post that I'm trying to, like, I've got lots of half blog posts that eventually I'll write, but I was interested in like notions of like sovereignty and kind of data governance and things like that. And like how, I suppose I wanted to link it in with basically like, so in the UK, a lot of the original kind of public libraries came about through basically working men kind of deciding to set up reading rooms and kind of collecting texts and having reading societies. So obviously that started way back when, like after, I don't know, like Thomas Paine wrote Rights of Man or whatever, you get all the English Jacobins and Irish Jacobins start reading it and kind of organising basically working men reading groups kind of thing. And then, you know, much later on, you kind of in the late 1800s, early 1900s, obviously you start to get like Victorian philanthropists that start setting up kind of something that looks a bit like public education or public libraries, but a lot of it is built by people that have very little money, but the money that they do have spare, they invest it into buying books and educating their own, essentially their own communities. You get things as well, like in the kind of early 1900s as well, a lot of working communities in the UK, like in industrial areas, like factory owners would build houses for the factory workers, but they would deliberately build the houses almost, I mean, it's an oversight, but they would build the houses with like one up, one down houses, we would call them. So you have a room at the bottom, a room at the top, but no running water, no easy way to heat water to have a bath at the end of the day. So then all the workers would have to organise to set up their own baths, which like, so everyone could have a wash after they came out of the colliery that they could wash and things like that. I don't know, so I wanted to kind of look at, people have had to kind of almost every point throughout history had to fight, and like, there's not someone that comes in, like philanthropy doesn't work basically, I suppose, to my mind, that people have to kind of fight for their own access or build their own kind of social justice kind of movements, I suppose, and build their own access by creating some sort of space or some sort of set of resources that then they give access to their community. So then you have to think of sovereignty, or you have to think of, I suppose, like ideas of commons as well, like basically open access, or things being open isn't necessarily good. And that's what Mackenzie Walk talks about a lot with vectorial capital, that when we make data open or we make resources open on the web or elsewise, there's power hierarchies between, you know, Google is able to take anything that ever existed on the web, index it, put it in whatever services that they have. But me or you as individuals, if we then go and look for a text or we go and look for a data set or whatever, the amount of time it takes us, the amount of individual skills that we have to have or access to different devices and whatever to do that, it takes us a lot of time. So there's an imbalance there of the value extraction that me versus Google can happen. So we're not taking the same value from the same set of open resources. So I was kind of interested in like infrastructures or how you organize governance and things like that over whatever resources are. I kind of think as kind of better ways of doing things or how people have done things in the past. I mean, even movements like Black Panthers and things like that, you know, how people have organized their own public education or access to food or whatever it is, their own cooperatives, because whatever else doesn't exist or they're deliberately disenfranchised from the things that exist for other people, kind of thing.
Yeah, the open thing is interesting because one of my like aha moments with EDUCAUSE's discussion of the next generation digital learning environment, the NGDLE. If that's not an acronym for you, I don't know what will be. But one of the things they said about that always struck me is they had this white paper in 2015, and then they had this follow-up in 2018, 17, is one of their like issues of a magazine they publish. And one of the essays was from a book publisher from McGraw-Hill or whatever. It was like a VP. And this book publisher was like, I am so glad everything's open. Like, we have all this. I mean, this is a closed proprietary book publisher. And the reason why he was so happy everything was open and accessible is it would allow them to pull, you know, the student data so freely from these systems to make the kind of algorithmic analysis of how well they are or aren't doing. And, you know, my criticism of the NGDLE up and to that point is like there was never any discussion of what this integrated system, what was its responsibility towards people's data and their relationship to that data and did they own it? And, you know, that was something that was all glossed over. It was all about corporations and third-party providers working with universities to create this next generation system. And it sounds very similar in that regard to this extractionist, you know, vision that is everywhere around us. And part of that is because there is no aesthetic and there is no like alternative propaganda, really at least well framed around this. But it's actually a kind of a transition to the next essay in some ways, because The next essay by, which I thought was awesome, so I wanted to talk about it just even a little bit, by Hito Steyerl, and I may be doing wrong on the last name, so let me spell it, Steyerl. Is that right, Lauren?
Steyerl. Hito Steyerl.
Got it. Whose essay is In Defense of the Poor Image. And I bring this one into this question because one of the things that I found interesting about this essay and found interesting is not only the, you know, the celebration of low resolution images and memes and GIFs and the like as, you know, a kind of a cultural kind of index of the moment, right? Or a window into, you know, how we understand the culture in which we exist right now. The web, fast, low resolution, remixing, but how all of that is navigated, as is the LMS and the surveillance system we talked about with the NGDLE just before, by these proprietary systems that make it impossible to get access to the original, or whether it's IP, proprietary copyright, things that I actually have run into problems with throughout my career as an ed tech. I've lost many and many a video on YouTube because I refused to acknowledge copyright in the way they decided I should. And I've actually spent the last 2 days working on using scripts to get all of my videos out of Vimeo, because I know I'm going to publish an essay, or not an essay, a blog post about Mario Bava's movie using clips that once Vimeo picks up, it will be my third strike and I'll be kicked off the system. So like, I know that this is not going to work for me, but I don't care, because I think it's important to feel like I can do that, and I can just feel like my data is free and easy to take with me and put somewhere else, which I plan to. But it's taken me almost 3 days to get 267 videos because they don't make it easy at all to get any of your stuff that you put in out. Even in a moment where we should have some recognition of this with, you know, the new laws, at least in Europe, around data portability and all of that. So it's interesting, the defense of the poor image, I love this essay for a lot of reasons, but even on just the surface of what kind of a, almost, how would I say it? It's almost like the defense of the poor image in some ways is a defense of like a system that does not let us in some ways, you know, effectively deal with the media kind of, and I've said this for a while, the media landscape in which we exist, right? We can't appropriate it. We can't really comment on it. And if we do, we run afoul of, you know, copyright law. And effectively, it's a way of silencing any discussion. But at the same time, and Brian Lamb said this again and again, and I promise I'll let you talk at some point this year,
is fine. I was going to just tweet out the link so people can see what we're talking about.
Cool. But Brian Lamb said, I've never gotten a takedown notice, and this is true for me too, for a GIF, right? I've never got anyone come and say like, you know, this GIF is being used, you know, illegally. I'm sure it's happened, but like the idea of authorship in the GIF never comes to bear. Like, I've authored many quote-unquote GIFs, but they're not mine. I took them from another piece of work, but I created the GIF, so to speak. But like, there's never this sense of ownership in my mind in the GIF, which for me linked back brilliantly to the first essay about, you know, a utopian, almost Le Guin-like vision of a kind of post-ownership. You know, there's that whole moment where you're talking about a post-ownership society where you come with nothing, you leave with nothing, you are the thing you create and are, and you kind of live the movement. And I don't know, I'm kind of all over the place with that essay, but that's because there's so much I want to talk about in it. Because I think...
Yeah, it's because Hito Chanel is dope. Yeah. That's what she is.
she's amazing, I tell you.
I love her so much. So in defense of the poor image, it's kind of... Again, so it's from Efflux. So Efflux is like a art and design and architecture kind of journal. And Hito Chanel is an artist. She started off making B-movies and stuff like that. And then she started writing reviews of artworks and art shows and stuff like that. And then she became a filmmaker. So her work sits within art. She's a filmmaker. And she's written, so In Defense of the Poor Image came out about 10 years ago. 2009. And I've tweeted out the link to it as well. She's also written an essay called, Too Much World, Is the Internet Dead? I've got that. This is a good book. I've just got loads of really good books. which would relate to this as well, where she talks about, the internet is dead, as in it's everywhere. So it's not that it doesn't exist anymore, but talking about the internet as a thing just doesn't really make sense when we're constantly connected and the way it's kind of restructured how we think and how we share information and stuff like that. So she talks about the value of images, who can make images. She works with, like, at different points, she's kind of built into the ideas of films who's working on them, or how they're funded. So I think, you know, when the writer's strike was happening in the US, she had a Hollywood cameraman who had been made unemployed at that point. And then she kind of makes references in her films during the time that she's making films in that time and stuff like that. But yeah, so in Defense of the Poor Image, it goes through how we value images, and then the broader potentials of us remixing and sharing images, and that, like you're saying, Jim, like that kind of no one author, or that like challenging the idea of something being authentic just because it's the original or it's high resolution. So
it's a really interesting kind of like almost digital update of Walter Benjamin in some really interesting ways, and different, but in some ways equally compelling. And one of the things she talks about in that essay that I loved, and I'm going to do more research on because I was introduced to it by the essay, was, I think it was Juan Espinoza, who's a theorist from Cuba, talks about this idea of imperfect cinema. And for him, I think the idea of perfect cinema, like the cinephile, the perfect, like she does a great riff throughout the essay on like all these, like, it has to be 35 millimeter, it has to be Blu-ray, it has to be, and like, I'm like loving it because I'm like, VHS, give me the lowest quality of like mass produced media you can, and then I'll make it lower by digitizing it. But like, there's this sense of her really like usurping that idea of this cinema of perfection, like the Stanley Kubrick male author. And she even talks about, they shouldn't talk about Kubrick, but there's this idea of it has to be this ratio, it has to be on the screen, like for it to be real or authentic. And I love the way in which she reinvokes this notion of an imperfect cinema, saying like, no, cinema needs to reflect the struggle of all the things that lead to this kind of fetishization of the image and of the idea. And I just love the way in which this is a manifesto in some ways. And she's not letting like, oh, just because it's low resolution, it's good. Or it's more, you know, it's more proletariat, right? Although she does talk about the lumpen image as a kind of joke. But she really talks about like the low resolution image is a kind of version of us caught within a low resolution of the existence with which we find ourselves in this system, right? Like, we've been captured at low res as a result of these systems that kind of hierarchize the idea of the image and property in the image. And I'm just like, this is a trippy, awesome essay. I really loved it.
She says stuff like as well, if an image becomes so low resolution kind of thing, maybe it has more value than the high resolution image because people have loved it so much that they've copied it and reversioned it and then put text over it and then done their own voiceovers and then someone else has taken it and it's just been passed from hand to hand to hand. And it's kind of the amount of care and love and attention that that image has had, even if it's like you can barely see the original face or whatever the information is in the image anymore because it's been copied so many times. Why would we not value that over the pristine image or the pristine cinema that very few people get to access that you can't hold as your own in some way? Do you know what I mean? It's dismantling the fetishization of images.
Yeah, and I really like that. There was actually a footnote in the essay where she talks about a Serbian, I believe, a Serbian archive. And makes reference to the idea of the future, you know, bookstore, no, the future kind of gift store of this Serbian archive was akin to a VHS store. And I was struck by that because I think of the VHS store we created in Fredericksburg as a kind of archive of that moment in very different ways. Like, I think her thinking is so cool because it makes me rethink some of my assumptions about the stuff I'm doing, which I really liked. But not that what I'm doing is important, but anyway, there was a connection. And she has this whole other essay, which is called, which I followed and read, which is called Politics of the Archive, translations of film. And she has this, two things, and I'll shut up. One, I really like the fact that, you know, she just digs in on like one version of a Serbian film or a Yugoslavian film that was created about World War II and talks about all the different versions of that film and how each of them are their own life based on the cut, based on the nationality, based on the dub, based on what format it was saved in, based on whether it was downloaded from Pirate Bay or whether it was gotten as a Blu-ray or what. It's just, she gets into this crazy textual analysis that I just love. But beyond that, she talks about this idea of, you know, the archive as something, at least in Serbia, that has been ultimately like, it's based on resources. And with the lack of resources, none of that stuff could be saved. So she talks about an image of the film that she was researching being cut at 3x4. And her whole idea was to try and track back, why was it like that? And it turns out the archivist didn't have the money to digitally transfer it. So they just set up a camera and they recorded the film playing. And so like it was like almost like digital archaeology, digital kind of sleuthing, almost like she was a detective, but also the way in which she understands film as a medium, or, you know, now as a medium, like with almost limitless like adaptations and versions of itself that is something like I'm doing right now. It's part of why I'm downloading all of my Vimeo videos, is I'm cutting up pieces of a film that I talked about with a class last week as a way to analyze the film, which I thought, I've been doing this for years. I think it's like, that's what we need to do. Like, how can we not have access to this resource given the web? But yet she really frames that beautifully within the context of, what audio, she calls it, what does she call it? She call it audio-visual capitalism. She has this whole terminology where, and I didn't even think about it, but like just based on all the different codecs, based on whether it's PAL, NSTC, like all the things I run into regularly with Tim when we're doing some of our VHS stuff, like there's so many unnecessary borders to getting access to these resources. And I mean, I have bought $200 worth of cables to try and like route around different formats between Europe and America to make some of my transfers work. It's ridiculous the amount of money you have to spend. A lot of this stuff is outdated. You have to have custom people who do it. It's just crazy. So anyway, that whole essay sent me in a whole nother direction, because the stuff I do doesn't really have, in my mind, any theoretical backing. And then I read her and I'm like, wait, like, there's a whole world here. It's super cool. So thank you for recommending it. I loved it.
Yeah. She said, I don't know. She's, so all of her writing as well is like, it's humorous. Like it's not, I don't know. So the essay that I mentioned before, the Internet is Dead one, she said like one of her headings, like it's just like a series of headings and then paragraphs underneath. And one of the headings is, I am a Minecraft, I'm a Redstone Minecraft computer or whatever kind of thing. And it's just like her declaring herself that as a, do you know what I mean? It's just like, this is my position now. This is how meta we're going kind of thing. And I don't know. It's just... So it's not to be read, like you said, about the lumpen image and stuff like that. She uses language in a very poetic way or whatever. It's not, yeah, I don't know, it's not dry in whatever way. But she said stuff, she's very good at cutting through about what's actually happening when people make images as well. So there's a, I can't remember what talk it was now, but she was like in a two-person talk that I watched a while back. I think this is just a recording online of something that happened at the ICA, and she just kind of stops the conversation. She was like, something that really bugs me is, and then she's talking about the propaganda videos that ISIS make and put on YouTube and whatever. She's like, all these media outlets saying how good they are and, oh, they must be so sophisticated. Oh, they've got really intelligent, you know, like filmmakers or whatever. She's just like, do you not understand how patronizing it is? And also they're just using default templates in After Effects kind of thing. So kind of cutting through the racism as well as the lack of understanding of how image making actually happens. And like the fact that she just cuts the stuff. She's like, by the way, this really annoys me and it doesn't really make sense to bring it up now, but I just want to shout it out kind of thing. I don't know. It's good.
I was actually thinking, it's one of the things when I was rambling, I didn't actually nail. And I realized I've been coughing, thinking I'm muting the mic and I am in our thing, but it may have gone over the radio. So if I'm coughing in the radio, I'm sorry. Anyway,
oh, no.
That might be the case.
I was protected from it.
Okay, yes, at least you, but they weren't.
Yeah, one person.
I was thinking I love the way she writes, meaning, you know, I like the way she writes, but also the way it's like paragraphs, sections. It's almost like a blog post. Like, it's a very few footnotes. It's kind of readable, right? Like some of it gets crazy, but then most of it's readable and fun. And it's like sectioned almost weird, like almost like Nietzsche, like puts in a paragraph of idea and then goes and then has a next idea. And they are loosely connected. But like in the one about the archives, it's like, H.26, right? What is it? How is it? How does it go? I just love it. It's a format. Like her whole thing is talking about an actual video format. What is it? It's 35 millimeter color positive. And then it's the one I loved is there's one on dubbing, subtitles, H.264. I was like, that's great. It's just a paragraph where she talks about H.264 and like the whole digital media run of things. And I was like, wow, that's super cool that she's just doing it.
Yeah, one of her films, I think it's literally titled Another Fucking Didactic Film, .mov. And that's yeah, that's what it's called. That way of writing is how film essays are constructed as well, that you're placing ideas that kind of tangentially relate but don't necessarily flow together, and then you kind of, by the time you finish watching the film, that you have this idea of, it's like a constellation of ideas rather than trying to stick to one thread or flow, because then you're limited by the ideas that you can explore. Whereas she's got like screenshots of Second Life based artworks and then like you say, like low resolution images or referencing kind of different file formats, and they kind of all form together to make this Defense of the Poor image, but it doesn't, it's not a neat kind of linear kind of journey or whatever.
It makes two things, because I have to wrap up here because I got to get on support. But I want to say two things before you wrap up. Two, not one, but two. Peace, victory, is one, I like the idea of a sci-fi movie discussion series on DS106 TV. You brought up a couple of sci-fi. We can make up syllabus. No one will watch and listen, but I don't care because I like doing that stuff. So maybe that's a project we work on if you're interested. Two is I love the idea of a DS106 TV thing or radio, whatever, where we talk about her work more. And with her, I mean a hero in the last name. How do you pronounce it?
Ito Shtel, yeah.
That's it, Ito Shtel. I don't know why I said hero. But
I could talk about it forever.
But really like dig into particular pieces, not just talk about her. We could talk about her, but like talk about one thing she says about like H.264 and then talk about H.264 using her as kind of a jump off point. Talk about formats. I'm really interested right now, for obvious reasons, in formats of digital and, you know, pre-digital video in particular, but media in general. I've been kind of alluding to it on my blog with these things I've been buying and trying to figure out stuff and archiving a lot of this stuff. So I'm not an audiovisual expert, right? And that stuff kind of eludes me, but I love learning about it. And I find the best way to learn about it is to schedule with someone to talk about some of that stuff based on that. So those are the two ideas that came out of, for me, this discussion that I'd love to pursue. Obviously, I want a reason to read Ito more and talk about that stuff because it's super cool and it reinforces stuff I'm already doing. And a sci-fi movie schedule would work brilliantly with my Eurocrime Poliziotteschi films I'm going to be doing with Paul Bond. So I could be sci-fi and Eurocrime.
That's a good combo.
So we could talk about that, but this has been fun. Last words. I don't want to cut you off here.
Be positive. Other futures are possible. Whatever's going on right now, we can make something that's better in future. Just need to, yeah, I don't know. People get down about different things, like whether you can't access the film you want to watch or if you would prefer to remodel the whole planet society differently. You know, like, I don't know. There's always hope in things. I think it's just trying to find things that give you hope. So both of these essays kind of give me hope in some way.
You really pulled that back from the edge because we had forgotten the whole utopian thing.
Yeah.
You saved us.
The idea of utopia is interesting as well. Maybe we discuss that sometime.
I think maybe that's enough, right? Like, we could do the sci-fi. We could do a utopia-based show. And it could be a movie, or it could be an essay, or it could be something. And then maybe keep with utopia because that's broad enough that it doesn't lock us in.
Yeah, that sounds dope.
Dope. I like dope. Cool. All right, Lauren, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for chatting. It's been fun.
Absolutely. And thank you, everybody, who is listening. I know, Alex, you were listening. So if you're still listening, big fan. You've been listening to DS106 Radio. This is the Utopian Radio Show. And who knows, this could be not only the first episode, but it could be the last, or it could be the beginning of, you know, the Utopian Parkway. Who knows? We will see. Bye-bye, all.
Bye.
Nice. God, let me get off the radio here. Okay.